we began to look at verses 15 through 23 about 3 weeks ago, and we have worked our way down to verse 18 in the study that we did last week in verse 17. We pointed out that the translation, "but thanks be to God," actually literally is an ascription of grace to God. And as a translation of gratitude, that's probably what they did mean in some senses. But nonetheless, even if it's thanks rather than grace, it's still grace. And the gratitude is an expression of recognition that God is behind this. And we looked at that verse 17 as an illustration of all the things that God has to do in grace in order to bring us to the point where we are. So the issue of verse 18 and 19, which is what we're going to get into this evening, the point is that we have to come to grips with the doctrine that men receive grace from God. When God speaks, they hear, they recognize it as true and yield to it. That's the biblical concept of believing Him. And then out of that faith comes some more gracious input that enables them to present the members of their bodies to Him as instruments of righteousness. And out of that presentation comes behavior that is righteous. And out of that behavior comes an extended, developing experience of the joy of life. So that life is, in some ways, a result of what we do. But you can't just put it on the doing level without understanding what's going on in between. And that's what Paul was driving at in verse 17 when he talks about the ascription of grace to God because we were slaves of sin, actually literally slaves to the sin, and we became obedient from the heart, which is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, and therefore necessarily involves God's working to change the heart. And then we became hearing, yielding, believing persons, so that the form of teaching that we had committed or presented to us became the basis for the rest of the process. And the rest of the process is dealt with in verses 18 and 19 because he's actually dealing with the mechanics of a grace process. And keep this in mind, when you talk about a grace-based or a grace-focused process issue, you have to keep in mind that grace is God's choice, and therefore he can bypass. I mean, James says, for example, God resists the proud, gives grace to the humble. You can derive from that the principle that if you will humble yourself before God, he will extend grace to you, because that's the statement. But the statement is also God resists the proud. But the fact is, if God always resists the proud, nobody would ever be humbled, because even humiliation by God for our sake so that we can receive benefit is an active part of his decision to not resist the proud but to give them grace in order to bring them to their place of humility and so on. So with God, you can't make any firm rules. He'll do as he pleases. That's his prerogative. That's part of why Jesus died, so that God could exercise his prerogatives outside of the boundaries of the demand of justice. So, in verse 18, it says, having been freed from the sin, literally, definite article, you became slaves of the righteousness, and that's a definite article too. And then in verse 19, he says, I'm speaking in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. Just as you presented your members as slaves to impurity, to lawlessness, resulting in more lawlessness, so present your members as slaves to righteousness, resulting in sanctification. So in verses 18 and 19, he's giving us some more insight into this process that he expects us to function by. Because in verse 15, when he says, shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace, and then vehemently rejects that option or that idea, he expects us to vehemently reject it and then practice what he is going to lay out for us. In verses 16 and following is what he's laying out for us. And basically, in the first half of the chapter, it's all about what Jesus did in our place for us, so that in him we get credit for everything he did. And that's part of the reason why we don't continue in the sin because we are identified with Jesus and we got credit for everything he did, and therefore we should function on that basis, and we can, because he said in verse 12, don't let sin be the king in your body, in your mortal body. Then in verses 15 and following, it shifts off of being in Christ to being in God's creation, where justice isn't the only problem. And I was thinking about that in this regard. I think a lot of people misunderstand the law of the harvest for the justice of God. Because I've heard lots of people say, what goes around comes around. That's a statement that in some ways is a statement of the law of the harvest. You put the seed in the ground, you're going to get the harvest back. It's the boomerang effect. But I think a lot of people, in terms of that, think that that's the issue of God's dealings with us at the relational level. And it's not. God's dealings with us at the relational level are all the in Christ issues where he has set justice out of the picture and is dealing with us graciously in a relational way. And we're to count on that. But in our counting on that, we don't get careless, because we also live in a created universe where cause and effect is fundamental. It may be the fundamental principle of all of creation. And even if God was like the deist said, he just wound it up and then set it aside and let it run, you'd still suffer the consequences of cause and effect, or benefit from the consequences of cause and effect, depending on your behavior. And Paul says, this is a principle you can't escape. Don't you know that? And so that's the issue. However, when we look at verse 18, having been freed from the sin, you became slaves to the righteousness. That sounds kind of, well, we'll get into that in a minute. What I was going to say is, it sounds kind of like a static statement, but it's not. We'll get to the reason why in just a minute. I want us to understand something, though, about the issue of freedom from the sin and bondage to the righteousness, because the two issues go together. The sin, technically, entered when Adam acted on his disbelief. When he ate a piece of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, it plunged his entire progeny into his sin as the sin that caused all the rest of the sinning. And that was because all of humanity is threaded together. We're in him by virtue of our being offspring of him, genetically and so on. So sin entered when he acted, and prior to that action, but before he acted on the disbelief, Adam was actually the free servant of righteousness. And what free servant means is he was capable, as a servant of righteousness, to function and do righteous things. That's what freedom is, the ability to function. Bondage is the demand to function when you can't, or being forced to function in a way that you don't want to. Paul will talk about that more in chapter 7. But nonetheless, before Adam acted, he was a servant of righteousness, automatically so. I mean, he didn't get up in the morning and have to present himself to God and his members as instruments of righteousness, because there was no conflict inside. He just naturally did everything God wanted him to do, because sin hadn't entered the picture. But after he took his bite of the fruit, he and everyone in him became slaves to the sin. And that's the issue of the sin entering. And the righteousness, that definite article concept, entered when the principle of promised faith was initiated by God. In other words, after Adam's sin became a bondservant of sin, the sin, God then initiated a whole new issue that they hadn't been aware of prior to that. It's called promised faith. But it was the issue of God making commitments that he himself would take upon himself to fulfill for everybody who would just trust him. That's the whole foundation of New Testament theology. Grace means God is acting on our behalf in our place so that we get the benefit of what is done because we're trusting him. The difference, as we've said it many, many times, is that in Christ, it was outside of our bodies. Christ did all this stuff up to and including Calvary and the resurrection from the dead. We get to benefit from that simply by trusting God, because God says, you believe me, you get credit for all of this. But the Spirit of Christ was placed in our bodies at Pentecost. That's when it began. And in that setting, the stuff that God is doing, he is now doing within us and through us and outwardly from us, it's still him doing it, even though it's our bodies he's using to do it. That's why Paul says to present your members as instruments of righteousness, so God can do this. And even Jesus said, everyone who does sin hates the light and flees from it, doesn't come to the light because he doesn't want his behavior exposed. But everyone who does righteousness comes to the light so that it might be made manifest that the works are wrought by God. And that's where the confusion comes, because people see human beings doing things and give credit to the human being who does it, without understanding that if that person is trusting God, the things he's doing are being produced by the Spirit of God dwelling in his body, being given the freedom to act through that body by the person's presentation of the members of his body to do it. And it goes all the way back to heart and mind things. The Spirit of God adjusts the values of our heart. He actually affects the way we think, and our bodies then act accordingly. So it's a confusion simply because we go on what we see rather than what God says. But the fact is, God initiated a new principle of promised faith, and before he did that, bondage to the sin was an absolute dominant reality. A person who is enslaved to sin can't do anything but sin. Verse 20 basically says that, it just doesn't use my words. But the fact is, being a slave to the sin means you're forced to do what is sinful because you're a slave to it. And that's an absolutely dominant thing because of the two issues involved in the sin. The fear of death, which drives the self-preservation selfishness, and the spirit that is involved in producing the behavior of the sons of the disbelief. So those two issues are dominant. You can't escape that. That's why even in chapter 7, Paul says, "O wretched man that I am, who's going to deliver me from the body of this death?" Or this body of death. But after God initiated this new procedure where he makes a promise, you trust him, he acts, you get the benefit. And I guess the clearest and best illustration of that is the friend of God named Abraham, who is the father of the faithful. Everyone who believes is attributed to being a child of Abraham, a son of Abraham. And Ishmael was a product of Abraham's physical abilities with Hagar. And Ishmael was a child of the flesh. And Isaac, Abraham didn't do anything differently. He did what he did with a different woman, his wife. But he didn't do anything differently. But he didn't produce Isaac. God did. From every appearance, it was Abraham and Sarah who produced Isaac. But the reason God made them wait till he was 100 years old for that to happen was so that nobody could say, oh, Abraham and Sarah produced a child. He made them wait until it was impossible for people to say that. And then he produced a child, but their behavior on the outward appearance is exactly the same. It had been for years, but had been unproductive. So that's where some of this confusion comes into play. And the difference between the bondage to the sin, which is absolutely dominant, and the bondage to the righteousness is that the bondage to the righteousness is not an absolutely dominant thing. It becomes a possibility, and it becomes an actuality at the point of faith. But if unbelief is in the picture, then being a servant to the righteousness no longer is a reality. In other words, everything depends on whether you're going to believe him or not. the righteousness is that which is produced by God through an alternative actor. In our case, in Romans 6, it's Jesus on the cross who gives us everything that is ours in order to escape the justice of God. And the freedom from the law of harvest in a negative sense, reaping corruption, we are free from that by the things that God is doing in our bodies, through our bodies, with our bodies, because we have presented our members to Him, and He is free then to do whatever He pleases through our, it looks like we're doing it, but we're not. And so it's what God produces by an alternative actor, either Jesus or the Spirit of Christ in us. And then the righteousness that is implemented when faith is in the alternative actor, then that's what's actually seen and produced. So the issue of bondage to the sin is, it's absolute and it's dominant unless God functions by grace and alters something. But the righteousness produced by faith is only produced when faith is being exercised. So there's no in-between reality. You're either a slave to the sin or you're a slave to the righteousness. And the difference is, this belief produces a dominant, absolute dominance. And faith, in a sense, produces the same kind of dominance by the Spirit, because that's what the promise is. The critical element that determines the nature of the bondage is the process. Hear, yield, present, and then God does whatever He does because you've heard and yielded and presented. Or in sin's case, you hear what sin claims, you yield to it, you present your bodies to sin, and then out comes the results. The critical issue is the nature of the doctrine delivered. If the doctrine's true and it's yielded to, the believer will, by yielding to it, become a tool of God for producing righteousness in the world. But in verse 19, Paul brings up a problem. He says, without a conjunction, there's no for and but, it's just, I am speaking in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. And the question is, why does he throw that in there? Well, I think he is because there is such a thing as a significant weakness of the flesh. And he has to say, okay, I'm going to give you a human illustration issue. This is human terms, because at the flesh level, there is a significant weakness that has to be addressed. And that means that the statement in verse 18, having been freed from the sin, you became the slaves of the righteousness, is directly tied to verse 17. When you heard, yielded, presented, and became a recipient of this gracious action by God, at that point you became free from the sin and you became slaves to the righteousness. But it only lasted as long as the faith that was exercised by the hearing, yielding process is in place. In other words, it's not permanent. It's not static. You weren't once free from the sin, and now you are slaves to the righteousness regardless. That's not true. You can become, again, a slave to the sin. That's what this whole thing's about. And you're not automatically a slave of the righteousness just automatically. You have to trust God in order for that to work. So in verse 19, there is this reality. There is a human weakness in this whole flaw. There is a problem here that makes the grace of God and the function by grace of a believer in life wholly dependent. And when I say wholly dependent, remember the caveat earlier. With God, you can't tell what He's going to do by grace. But as far as human beings are concerned, you can count on God being gracious if you're willing to follow the process here. And that is, trust Him. The reason why the bondages, the one to the sin and to the righteousness, are dynamic and not static is partly because God's redemption is as yet incomplete. It's an ongoing, incrementally developing reality. The redemption of the soul of man is absolute because that redemption of the soul is completely wrapped up in being identified with Christ. That's the first paragraph of this chapter. When we are placed into Christ, our souls are irrefutably, you can't change it, it's done deal, you are redeemed. Your soul has been redeemed. You are in Christ and you are not subject to the justice of God, period. That's the promise of verse 14. Sin cannot be a lord over you because law has been removed from the picture. But the redemption of the body of man has not yet happened and will not be an established fact until there is a literal resurrection of the body. Now, for the terminal generation, which actually participates in the rapture in that instant of time, there is no lingering process of dying and then being raised 3 days later or however long, 2,000 years later or whatever. It's an instantaneous change from mortality to immortality. But there is this necessity of the change because the body is apparently irredeemable. It has to die before the reality of the redemption of the body can become a fact. By the power of resurrection. And when our bodies are raised, they are raised immortal, so they are fundamentally altered. The resurrection of the body is not bringing the same old body back into play. That would be resuscitation. That's what happened to Lazarus. He got resuscitated. He didn't get a new body, so he had to die again. But the fact is, we have to deal with the fact that we live in a body that produces this weakness of the flesh problem. Because the weakness of the flesh is a permanent reality until resurrection, the process is absolutely critical. We have to keep on hearing, we have to keep on yielding, we have to keep on presenting, and we have to keep on realizing that we're dependent on the Spirit of God to produce the behavior out of our bodies that will bring us to the experience of life. This is an incrementally developing thing. With bondage to the sin, the incremental development is a downward spiral into deeper and deeper levels of death. All sin can do is produce more death. So the longer you're in bondage to sin, the worse it gets. Your life just becomes more and more and more an experience of death at all kinds of levels. In the same way, in reverse, trusting God and being a recipient of the benefit of the Spirit of God producing behavior that brings back upon us the experience of life is an incrementally developing upward spiral where there are lots of areas of death in our experience, but as we trust God and as He produces this behavior through the instrumentality of our members, we get, by repercussion, the experience of life. And the longer we do this, the more of life we experience. So it's an upward spiraling, incrementally developing experience. Enough adjectives, adverbs, whatever. So, speaking as a human being on account of the weakness of the body or the flesh means that we have a most fundamental need to understand the details of the process. That's why Romans 6 was written. The original process that led to bondage to the sin is the same process that leads to bondage to the righteousness. The original process is simply, according to verse 19, presenting, which is after you have heard and yielded, presenting your members. He says in verse 19, you presented your members as slaves to impurity and to the lawlessness and resulting in more lawlessness. In other words, presenting a body or the members of a body to the sin is fundamentally a presentation to uncleanness. And that produces violations of behavior that are known to be wrong, and they just produce more. Lawlessness is doing things that you know by law are wrong, or not doing things you know by law are right. And every time you do that, you just get deeper into the mix, and you end up doing more and more of it. That's the same process, he says, according to verse 19, that you have to follow in becoming a consistent slave to the righteousness, and that is, you present your members as slaves to the righteousness. And the result from that is what he calls sanctification. Sanctification as a doctrinal concept is what I've called the upward, incrementally developing spiral of the experience of life. You become more and more practiced in the art of hearing, yielding, presenting, and so on. So the whole issue here is it's the same process, it's just a difference in what you're listening to. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and he told me that he had an opportunity to visit with a retired teacher that used to be at seminary. In their discussion, the comment was made about how radically different the incoming students at seminary are now from 20 years ago. Because when they came 20 years ago, there was already some kind of a foundation laid upon which it was fairly simple to build understanding. And now they come with absolutely nothing. And therefore, the seminary ends up scrambling constantly, trying to bring these students who are going in 4 years to be the masters of the universe in their own mind. They're going to go out and turn the world on fire in order to get them from absolutely no foundation to these masters of the universe. They've got to scramble to get them up to speed. And the fact is, you can't do it. So sanctification is a long and, in some senses, tedious process. You have to be involved in the consistent application of the principles. That's why it's so critical to be in a situation where you're regularly hearing the truth from God, the truth about God from God, the truth about yourself from God. And it has to be done in such a way that you can see that what's being presented is the truth so that you can yield to it. And having yielded to it, then you simply automatically present your body, your members of your body, to the application of that truth. And the Spirit of God takes over and then produces it. And then what is produced creates a harvest that comes back in benefit to the person who is operating by this process. So, bottom line, verses 18 and 19 say, at the point of faith, you become free from the sin. You become a slave to the righteousness. But you can't expect an act of faith to carry you all your days. You have to recognize that the bondage to the righteousness is a result of believing God, presenting your members as instruments to Him, and then on a very regular basis, just continuing to practice the same principle over and over and over. Because that's how the growth goes. And that's one reason why Christianity works, in spite of a lot of things, because the principle that works never changes. If God makes something clear to you and you yield to it, the Spirit of God will produce through you righteousness that will come back upon your head in blessing. That's a universal, never-changing fact of promise faith. So, in a lot of ways, it kind of makes a lot of the New Testament sort of redundant, because you don't have to know all this stuff to do that. But you do have to be exposed to this stuff as a part of the process of hearing from God, yielding to it, and so on. What you hear from God today will not be what you hear from tomorrow or the next day, because He's not into simply getting you to do one thing over and over and over and over again. He's into conforming you to the image of His Son, which means taking on all of the complexities of your life and addressing them incrementally over time until there is a kind of Christ-likeness showing up. So I really believe that verse 18 and 19 is not telling us that there is this static thing that's happened. You became free from sin, you became a slave to the righteousness. He didn't say that's a static reality. He says that's what happened when you believed Him, when you yielded to this process. And because of the weakness of the flesh, you're going to have to face it day after day after day after day until the body is redeemed. And then once that's happened, then you can forget about it because it'll happen to you naturally. But until then, it's not a natural process. It's a warfare. It's a consistent, prayerful kind of dependence.